Welcome to the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, part of the Kansas Cyclist website and the eRow Podcast Network. Podcasts that inform by focusing both on the news and the people behind the news. My name is Edward eRow, and together with Randy Reza, webmaster of the Kansas Cyclist, we are your hosts for episode 19 on April 28th, 2010. In this episode, we will be interviewing Alvin Wolf Jr., who is a trial lawyer from St. Louis who handles bicycle accidents. Our podcast provides news and information about bicycling in Kansas and neighboring states and is a feature of the Kansas Cyclist website, which is found at kansascyclist.com. Links to the Kansas Cyclist podcast can be found at the website and at the eRow Podcast Network on the web at epn.ero.com. We would like to thank our sponsors, Action Wipes, VeloCal, and Grease Monkey Wipes for their support. If any of our listeners are interested in becoming a sponsor of the Kansas Cyclist podcast or have general feedback on the show, please write to podcast@kansascyclist.com or call our phone number at 913-938-6855, as we would be very interested in hearing from you. Well, some strange weather we've been having lately. I'd actually thought, you know, it was going to warm up, and now, of course, the sun is shining outside as we record this. So, but it was mighty cold last night. And then I noticed on your Facebook posting, and then talking to you earlier, that you rode 85 miles to Lawrence and back on Monday, and that was a pretty cold northwest wind, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I actually had to dig out my winter stuff and gloves and hat and all that business. And yeah, it was tough and it was cold. I hadn't ridden for several days. I think I rode like once in a 10-day period, which is unusual for me. And
wow.
That hurt.
Yeah. Was it a little easier coming back?
Oh, yeah. That makes a big difference.
Yeah.
I guess you rode the Spring Classic on Saturday, and that was... It was wet, but the conditions weren't quite so bad, were they?
Yeah, I had actually woke up. I went to bed Friday night thinking, you know, this is really iffy. And there was, when I checked the weather early in the morning, it was the tornado warning, or tornado watch, excuse me, up until like 4 a.m. But then I looked at the fronts and I said, you know, we're right between all this stuff. And I said, you know, heck, this could be a go. It was cool temperatures, 60. I think it was about 62 degrees at the start, and then it warmed up a bit, but we also had quite a wind, much more than I expected. It was out of the southeast, and it was, you know, the flags were completely unfurled, so it was, you know, I'd figuring about 18 to 20 miles an hour. But it was, as always, Johnson County Bicycle Club did a fantastic job, very... well organized, well marked, and there was some areas that there was some road construction, and they managed to get around that with some detours very well. So I enjoyed it. Had good, kept up a nice pace. Actually, at the beginning, I was with some riders, and we were averaging probably 18 to 20. But then turning into the wind, you know, how that slows you down. But then coming back, it was right back up to, you know, probably 20, 25 miles an hour at one spot. And only had one close call. There was a group of three women that were going by me on tri-bikes. They looked like they were part of a team and going faster than I was. And then all of a sudden, a dog came out from the right. And... first woman screamed, and it scared the dog, fortunately, because that could have been a major pileup, and I think I would have been included in that, too, because I was just to their right. So, but all in all, a great, great time, and I actually started a blog, and I've written some information about the all the rides I'm doing now, but on that particular ride, I... rode up and took a few pictures of the sag and stuff too, and just rain just at the end for me. It was like started around 12 o'clock and I finished I think right around 12:30, and it was light at first, but then it really started coming down. And then I wish I would have had a little warmer clothing on, because I went with summer wear. You know, that's so different than what you experienced. It was really, I was hemming and hawing at the beginning, whether I saw some people with dressing warm, and I hate to overdress, but then you want to have something along. But I figured that it was kind of humid, and you know, temperatures were going to go up, and I was pretty much right. I hit it right on, except at the end I was a little bit cold.
Well, I understand you have a new blog.
Yeah. Well, as you know, and others that have read it now, you were the inspiration, because you're the blog man. I love reading your Dirt Bum blog, and of course all the adventures you take on your bicycle, which are much more than I can ever dream of. But I thought it'd be a good idea, and rather than just speeding by places, I have called setting my Garmin to auto pause, and that way all that means is that it turns off if you stop, and that's okay, you know. So taking the time to learn a little bit about the places I go, and took a ride. My first post, I went on some roads that I'd usually do with the Quivira Park bike group, and learned some things about places that I'd always passed but never really took the time to learn about them, like when Kill Creek Park was built, or the Prairie Center, and that they had a whole, you know, set of trails behind there. I never knew that. So it's fun. And I thank you for the inspiration on that.
Well, I think it's fun, too, to find out some about the history and the details of the country that you're riding through, and, you know, not just put your head down and pedal.
Right. Exactly. And that's, I think I was in that mode before, and I think it is important to take some time. Well, let's get into the news and information. Any highlights from the last episode?
Well, cycling news has actually been a little thin lately, and considering that this is the time of year when the fair weather cyclists begin to ride again, I guess that's not a bad thing. I really don't want to have to report on people getting hit and killed on our roads, so no news maybe is good news. I have heard a few reports of some collisions, some from Wichita, a couple from Manhattan, a few from the Kansas City area, but so far no fatalities, unless I missed some. There has been some good news coming out of Missouri recently. The Missouri Bicycle Federation reports that the Tour of Missouri is apparently still alive. Funding for the tour passed through the Missouri General Assembly, albeit at a lower level than last year, $1 million versus $1.5 million. The legislators apparently understood that the tour more than paid for itself through sales tax revenue. But the final decision for the tour rests with the governor, and organizers are still asking for our support. Calls and emails can still help the governor make the right decision. Also moving through the Missouri legislature is a bicycle sales tax holiday, a complete streets resolution, and a safe passing bill. One other thing to note in Missouri is that a contract has now been awarded for a bike ped path across the Missouri River at Jefferson City, which will connect the state capitol with the Katy Trail. For anyone who's braved that busy six-lane bridge by bike, you can attest to the need for that bike ped path, which will be attached to the main bridge but separated from traffic. The new path is expected to be completed next year about this time. And next up, we have an advocacy alert. The Kansas Department of Transportation is holding a public meeting on April 29th in Edgerton, Kansas, to discuss a proposed new interchange along I-35. The interchange would be located on or near 199th Street, which is currently a popular cycling route in southwestern Johnson County. It's one of the few low-traffic east-west routes in that area, and the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad is planning to build an intermodal facility nearby, which will be used to transfer freight from trains to trucks. This facility is projected to completely change the complexion of the area, adding over 7,000 trucks per day to the roads and thousands of housing units nearby. The interchange needs to take into account the needs of the people who will be living, working, and shopping in the area, many of whom will be traveling by bike. The public meeting will be a good chance for the cycling community to speak up and ensure that their needs are being considered in the planning of this interchange. This is local for me, so I'll definitely be there, hopefully by bike. The meeting takes place Thursday, April 29th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Midvale Farms near Edgerton.
That's great. Another just update, Tim and Cindy Travis, who we talked with on a podcast last summer, are now headed to India for the next stage of their what is never-ending world tour. And they just spent the winter in Indiana with family. So we wish them the best as they go on to the next segment of their adventure. The other thing is they have a new book out titled Down the Road in Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam, A Bike Tour Through War, Genocide, and Forgiveness. And that has now been published. And if you go to their website, it is downtheroad.org, it is available there. As always, to keep up with the latest cycling news from Kansas and neighboring states, subscribe to the Kansas Cycling News at the website. You can subscribe by using an RSS feed reader or via email. And for more timely information, you can follow the Kansas Cyclist and the Kansas Cyclist podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Our next section is the upcoming rides section, and Randy has many rides that are detailed on the website. Looks like you have quite a few for this episode to talk about.
Yeah, we have a really busy weekend coming up, so let's talk about those moving from east to west. On Saturday, May 1st, the Bull Creek Bike Bash rolls out of Spring Hill, Kansas, with mileage options from 20 to 60 miles. The $20 registration fee includes both a t-shirt and lunch after the ride. Spring Hill is located just south of the Kansas City metro area off Highway 169.
And that's the one you were thinking of doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I should, because it's really local to me, just like 5 miles away. So I'm going to do it if I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like the weather, looks like we have a couple days of sun, but then the long-term forecast looks like more rain again. So
It may be a rainy weekend.
Yeah.
Also in the Kansas City area this weekend is the Kansas City Women on Wheels Bike Festival, which takes place this year on May 1st at Shawnee Mission Park. The festival targets first-time cyclists with a short women's-only group ride, plus a bike safety rodeo for kids, a bike swap meet, bike repair clinics, and vendor information booths. Chanute, Kansas, located in the southeastern part of the state, hosts the Ride for Life bicycle tour on May 1st as a fundraiser for cancer research with 9-mile and 30-mile rides. This is the very first year for this ride, and I hope they get a nice turnout and can make this an annual event. It's good to see a ride to come to that community.
Mm-hmm.
And on May 2nd, the Great Escape ride takes place near El Dorado, Kansas, just northeast of Wichita. They're riding here for a really interesting cause, which is raising funds for the Spiritual Life Center at the El Dorado Correctional Facility in the state prison. The ride offers 20, 50, and 80-mile routes through the Flint Hills. And further west in Salina, the Road to Recovery is a fundraising ride on May 1st for the American Red Cross with 20, 40, and 80-mile route options. Like the Chanute ride, this is, I think, the first year for the event, and they're hoping to make it an annual tradition.
It's nice to see all these new rides.
Yeah, it is. And moving to the south a bit, the Sand Plum Bicycle Classic is another inaugural event happening for the first time, this one taking place May 2nd out of Hutchinson. This ride raises money to help build trails in Reno County. And Hays, Kansas, hosts the Rope'em ride with mileage options from 5 to 100 miles. And this ride showcases some of the many historical cathedrals in the region and is a popular yearly event in western Kansas. And finally, we have the Kansas Fat Tire Festival, which offers 2 days of mountain bike racing on the trails at Lake Wilson. I haven't been there yet myself, but these are reputed to be some of the very best trails in the state. There are hill climb and short track events on Saturday, and a kids race and a cross country race on Sunday. This event is part of the United Federation of Dirt series of mountain bike events in Kansas and Missouri. Mm-hmm. And in other states around the region, you might want to check out the Salamos Revenge mountain bike race in Arkansas, the Tulsa Tough races in Oklahoma, and the Trail to a Cure ride on the Cadian Trail starting and ending in Rocheport, Missouri on May 1st.
So it goes out and comes back, is it?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And that's a really scenic part of the trail.
Yes, that is. Well, remember, for a complete listing of upcoming rides and races, visit the events section of the website. These listings will have more details on how to sign up for the events, with both registration information and links back to the actual ride websites. We wanted to spend a moment and talk about Action Wipes, one of our sponsors, and in fact, our first sponsor on the podcast. Action Wipes are made specifically for athletes using 100% natural ingredients, including pure oils such as tea tree and eucalyptus, and take it from our experience, they do work. So stop using baby wipes with all that alcohol that can and does dry out your skin with repeated use, and try Action Wipes. For more information, go to the Kansas Cyclist website, and you will see an ad with a link to the order. All Kansas Cyclist podcast listeners get 15% off their orders by using the website link or by just entering Kansas on their orders. In accordance with new FTC regulations, the Kansas Cyclist podcast is not provided free Action Wipes and receives remuneration only through the sales on the website. Okay, now it's time to look at new trails to try. Randy has links to almost all of the riding trails in Kansas and adjoining states on the website, but is there a trail or some trails that you'd like to talk about in this episode?
Well, no trail reports, but I do have a bit of trail news I can share. The Burroughs Creek Trail in eastern Lawrence is apparently getting closer to completion. This is a rails-to-trail project covering just a mile or two, but it's going to be an important north-south link in the city. I actually rode past there yesterday, and it looks like they're making good progress. They hope to have it open by the end of July.
Now, where is that exactly? What side of?
Well, it's on the east side of Lawrence, east of downtown. I came in on, I think, 15th Street and crossed, you know, right through the trail right away.
Oh, that is interesting.
And the bill to make the Prairie Spirit Trail an official state park is currently in committee in the state legislature and is expected to be voted on before the session adjourns. The trail is currently run by the State Parks Department, but it's not an actual state park. State park designation would mean additional attention and exposure for the trail, hopefully leading to more people using it. The 51-mile trail is a really good place to ride and walk, but I don't think it gets the number of visitors it deserves. Mm-hmm. And finally, Sunflower Recreational Trails reports that there's an organization working to build a 40-mile-long recreational trail in the historic corridor of the Santa Fe, Oregon, and California trails from Independence, Missouri to Gardner, Kansas. Some of the attractions along the trail, such as Lone Elm Park in Olathe and Gardner Junction near Gardner, have already been built. Both of those sites are local to me, and I can testify that they are really interesting places to ride to, even without the trail.
Well, that sounds wonderful. So this is just in the initial phases, though?
I guess it's in the planning stage. Uh-huh. I have no idea, you know, about finding right away and stuff.
Yeah, that'd be great, because there's so many times you, when you're out riding, and just Saturday on the Spring Classic and the 70 mile, there was a place that I went by, I think it was the Oregon Trail. So it's really neat to see some of that history come together.
Well, this area has a really amazing history, though. Trail.
Yeah.
All those trails ran right through here.
Right.
They split at Gardner. Gardner is known as where the trails divide. And that's what Gardner Junction, it's not a monument, but it's a little small little park and informational display. That's what that is.
Yeah. Well, as always, Randy has several, if not all, the trails in Kansas and surrounding states on the website. So if you see one that's not listed, be sure to let him know, because I know he'll want to put that up. Randy, I know we've had some feedback. Why don't you share with our listeners what we've heard?
Well, we've actually heard from several people. Most of those were just general comments, letting us know that they enjoy the show, and we really do appreciate hearing that. I did get one specific question about last episode, where we talked about riding bikes on gravel roads. The question was from Steve and Shawnee, who asked, what characteristics make a good gravel bike? Is it a road bike that is manned up, or is it a mountain bike that is roaded up? Should you use drop bars or mountain bars? Well, that's a really good question. I think either road bikes or mountain bikes will work fine, at least for shorter distances. A mountain bike is usually going to have fat tires and probably some sort of suspension, so it'll handle the rough roads really well, but it might not be the best choice for long distances. A road bike, on the other hand, is more comfortable for long distances, but may be less able to handle the rough roads or loose gravel. One really good option is a cyclocross bike, which is essentially a road bike with drop bars, but it'll handle fatter tires than a road bike will.
Yeah, I can attest, because Randy gets me out on these gravel roads, and I have a road bike, and generally, you know, depending, I mean, you wouldn't want to do it off after a big rain, but I can usually find smooth spots. But you do have to be careful. You have to kind of really navigate through some of the loose gravel.
Yeah, there's usually at least, you know, two lanes of smoothness.
Yeah.
The only problem you run into is where they've recently put down fresh gravel.
Right.
And then you've got the whole width of the road that's nothing but loose rock. And that would beat you really up on a road bike.
Yeah.
In choosing a bike, I think tire size is really the crucial parameter. A wider tire can be run at a lower pressure, and a lower pressure tire provides a softer ride, which is essentially a form of passive suspension. A cushier ride is going to beat you up less than a harsh ride, meaning that you're more comfortable and meaning that you can ride for a longer time with less fatigue. The problem with most road bikes is that they're really optimized for road racing, meaning really skinny, high-pressure tires. That's what you want for maximum efficiency on smooth pavement, but it'll beat you up on the rough roads, and it'll feel kind of skittish on the loose surfaces. Some road bikes will accept fatter tires, but most won't. The bike I ride, a Surly long-haul trucker, which is nominally a touring bike meant for carrying heavy loads on paved roads, will take really fat tires. In fact, one of Surly's company taglines is "Fatties fit fine." Okay. My bike will handle a tire up to about 2 inches in width, which is a double what many racing bikes will accept.
And you do that too. You have a couple sets of tires yourself, right?
I actually have two sets of wheels.
Wheels, yeah, that's what I meant.
One mounted with slick tires, which I use for pavement rides, and one with slightly knobbier tires, wider tires, for gravel rides. The other parameters about a bike, you know, weight, what material it's made of, you know, drop bars versus straight bars, matter less, I think. As long as you're comfortable on the bike and it'll take reasonable width tires, you should do fine. Of course, if you're racing or doing long endurance rides, weight does become more of an issue, as does the ability to carry food and water and other gear. But in general, I'd say, you know, just use whatever you have and give it a try on gravel and see how that works. You can always swap out to fatter tires later if you can, but just take it slow and upgrade later once you get a feel for what works and what doesn't.
And you and I were talking earlier before we got on the podcast. You know, I was saying that I've been watching on Versus, some of the road racing. I love watching that. I tape it and I can fast forward through stuff. And they've had some of the classic races, the Flanders, and the Paris-Roubaix race, where you go on cobblestones, and they seem to have road bikes. But I heard them talking, I guess they use like a deeper rim. on these, and so there is a little bit of a difference, but boy, they are bouncing around on those. I think that's just an absolute insanity. I've never seen more crashes on those, but I guess the riders just love them, and I guess it's quite an honor to win one of those races. But
well, I can see why they would think of it as something different anyways. I mean, it's not just crank on the road. It's an extra challenge.
Yeah, well, actually, the Tour of France this year will have a section with the cobblestones. So I think they're all kind of practicing up for that.
Of course, in the early years of the Tour, a lot of the roads weren't paved.
That's what they were. So, well, please do contact us. We'd love to hear from you. And that was a great discussion, you know, on the gravel road. So if you've got other ideas or comments, please let us know. You can send an email to podcast@kansascyclist.com or our new phone number, 913-938-6855. And, you know, if you leave a recording, we'll even can put that on the podcast as part of it if you have a question or comment. So do let us know, or you can comment on the news blog, Facebook page, or even through Twitter. Before we talk about some bicycling safety tips, we wanted to talk briefly about Grease Monkey Wipes, one of our sponsors. What Grease Monkey Wipes are is individually packaged degreasing cleaning wipes that utilize a natural, non-toxic citrus formula to handle heavy-duty cleaning, including bike grease and road grime. I have used Grease Monkey Wipes now several times, and they are handy after working on your bike before the ride, after the ride, or possibly for a mid-ride repair, such as fixing a flat tire. Due to the portable nature of the product, Grease Monkey Wipes easily fit in a saddlebag or a jersey pocket. The durable nature of the wipes allows them to clean not only your skin, but also an oily chain, a dirty frame, and more. Kansas Cyclist Podcast listeners can receive 15% off by entering Kansas as the coupon code, and there is also a direct link to Grease Monkey Wipes at the webpage. As with other disclosures and in accordance with new FTC regulations, the Kansas Cyclist Podcast is not provided free Grease Monkey Wipes and receives remuneration only through the sales on the website. Continuing a feature of our podcast, which we call Bicycle Safety Tips, we're going to talk about bicycle helmets, why you might want to wear one, how to choose a helmet, and proper helmet fit.
Yeah, frankly, this is not a topic that I think a whole lot about. In the groups I ride with, and I think you're probably the same, everyone wears a helmet without exception. It's just a standard part of the gear. And in fact, on most organized rides, they require you to wear a helmet if you want to participate in the event.
Yeah, I know Johnson County Bike Club, that's part of their requirement. I know on the ride I do, we follow JCBC rules, and I have it right on there to wear a helmet. So, right. Yeah, absolutely.
But apparently helmet use is not as universal as it seems to us. Last year, Consumer Reports magazine reported that 58% of cyclists never wear a helmet. My first reaction to that was never. I mean, I can understand someone confessing that they occasionally don't wear a helmet, but 58% never wear a helmet. To me, that number sounded really, really high. But in subsequent discussions with various people in the cycling community, I've come to realize that apparently I lead a sheltered life. Urban cyclists, students on campuses, the working poor, many of these riders do indeed never wear helmets, and in many cases don't even own one. And I guess that's understandable, kind of. A helmet is an extra cost. A helmet is another thing to keep track of, another thing to worry about leaving behind in a restaurant or being stolen. A helmet can be hot. It can mess up your hair. It can make you look even goofier than normal. Face it, you know, most helmets aren't really fashionable.
Yeah, and I've found, too, you know, like you said, on the rides that I go on, everybody's got a helmet on. No, I know sometimes when I go on the trails, and there's more families out. I'm always shocked to see families, you know, mother, father, and they might have 2-3 children, and none of them have helmets on. And that, you know, I just don't understand. And especially since there's so many places like Headstrong for Jake has numerous occasions here in the Kansas City area where people can go and get free helmets. So it does surprise me that that percentage is so high. The big thing, however, is that the Bicycle Helmet Safety Institute estimates that a very high percentage of cyclist brain injuries can be prevented by a helmet, and other studies say anywhere from 45% to 88%. And yes, a bicycle helmet does indeed cost a little bit of money. You know, I think people say they look goofy, but, you know, if you're into road racing and stuff, they're kind of cool too. And I think that's probably some of the ones that are a little bit more expensive. But I think the real cost is how much does a head injury cost? And, you know, what does that do to your life in the long term? So, you know, how fashionable is a cracked skull? And really, you don't need to spend a lot of money on protection. If you go to the Bicycle Helmet Safety Institute site, we found that cheap helmets are and expensive helmets perform really equally well in impacts. And the extra cost is maybe more in an easier fit, more vents, maybe not as hot, some snazzier graphics. But the basic impact protection of the cheap helmets is tested equally with expensive ones. And I was quite surprised by that.
Yeah, I mean, they all have to meet pretty much the same tests. But when I've talked with bike shop owners about this, they said that the more expensive helmets are actually tested to higher standards. And yes, the cheap ones do pass the test, but their helmets pass even more stringent tests. And the difference in comfort between the lower-end models and even mid-range models can be pretty significant. The more expensive helmets are lighter, and they have more and larger air vents. The argument here is that if it's more comfortable, you'll be more likely to wear it, and I think there's certainly some truth to that. Personally, I wear a fairly low to mid-range mountain bike helmet. It's a Bell Yukon. I think I've spent $30 on it on sale, something like that.
Yeah, mine's an older Giro road helmet, so it was, I think, popular when the Discovery team was out, so I think that's about 2006, 2007, and I got it on sale at the end of the season at a bike store, and I just can't quite remember, but I think it was around $80 to $120. It wasn't more than that, I would have remembered.
Okay, so let's assume that you have a helmet. What's the proper way to wear it? You want the helmet to be comfortably touching your head all the way around, and level and stable enough to resist even violent shakes or hard blows and not move around. It should be as low on the head as possible to maximize side coverage, and held level on the head with the strap comfortably snug. If your helmet came with foam pads, you can use those to customize the shape. The pads should touch your head evenly all the way around without making the fit too tight. If your helmet uses a fitting ring rather than pads for adjustment, you want to snug the ring down tight enough to feel stable when you move your head, but not so tight as to feel binding. The helmet should sit level on the head with the front just above the eyebrows, or if the rider wears glasses, just above the frame of the glasses. A key test is when you walk into a wall, the helmet should hit before your nose does.
Yeah, I see so many times people have their helmets too far back on their head, and when we were doing the research for this, it was quite interesting because really, you know, once you put the helmet on and fasten the buckle under your chin, there is a test that was developed by the Bicycle Coalition of Maine, and I had never heard this. It's called Eye, Ear, Mouth, so EEM. First thing is, when you look upward, the front rim should be barely visible to your eye. Now, I think unless Randy, if, correct me, I know some of the mountain bikes have those visors, so I don't think we count that. Second, the Y of the side strap should meet just below your ear, and I know I've have adjusted mine that way. And then the chin strap should be snug against the chin, so when you open your mouth very wide, you feel the helmet pull down, but not so snug when you have your mouth closed that it's choking you. And then for a final check, look in the mirror and move the helmet side to side and front to back, watching the skin around the eyebrows. It should move slightly with the helmet. When you are done, your helmet should be level, feel solid on your head, and comfortable. You should forget you are wearing it most of the time, just like a seatbelt or a good pair of shoes. If it still does not fit that way, keep working with the straps and pads, or perhaps try another helmet, because I think some people, you know, just like anything, they like the styling of it, and, oh, I'll just be uncomfortable. It really is important to have a comfortable fitting helmet, and I know, you know, I put mine on, I don't even think about it, and I don't even remember I have it on.
Yeah, it becomes second nature.
Right.
Finally, many communities have annual bicycle rodeos, which will not only teach kids bike safety, but will provide free helmets if they're needed. They'll also fit the helmets properly for your child, and many police departments and fire stations will also provide free helmets and fittings for kids.
Yeah, that's Headstrong for Jake that I was saying earlier. They do a lot of that.
Also note that some states require that all children under a certain age wear a helmet. However, none of the states in our region mandate this, although some individual communities may do so. You probably want to check with your local police if you're not sure about this. I guess ultimately wearing a helmet or not is a personal decision, and we hope you'll wear one. I personally consider it pretty cheap insurance.
Absolutely, and I know we talked in a previous podcast about some helmet issues. I know I was with my wife, and we were on a trail. This was when we lived up in Michigan, and it was kind of a cinder trail, rails to trail thing, and she hit a loose piece of gravel through the front part of the bike, and she fell off. It didn't really flip, but she went down pretty hard. I mean, hurt her leg and had a lot of bleeding, and then we noticed the helmet, how hard that it hit there. And if that had been her head, that would have been a, you know, maybe not a life-threatening thing, but certainly probably would have had a pretty hard concussion from it. So,
well, I have a story to tell there too. I mean, I had a mountain bike crash a couple of years ago, and apparently hit my head pretty hard on the ground. I don't really remember that part of it, but later on I found a stick embedded in the helmet, and you know, I look at that and think, wow, that stick could have been embedded in my head.
Right.
So I'm a believer.
Yeah. I mean, Carol had the same thing. She didn't remember hitting her head. And see, that's good, you know, because you have the helmet on. I'm sure there's some crashes that you're going even harder that you're going to hurt your head too, even with the helmet, but that, or, you know, maybe not even surviving. So I agree. I think it's real cheap insurance, and once you start wearing it, it's second nature. So, well, we'll be discussing again in the next episode another area of bicycle safety. If you have any comments on what we've said, or agreement, disagreement, I think one thing that would be nice to hear from our listeners is, you know, should there be mandatory helmet laws? I know in some states it's probably pretty hard. Here in Kansas, we don't even have helmet laws for motorcycles, which surprises me. In other states, they do, so it's probably a hard
thing.
I think
we actually do for under, what, 18 or something.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, I just see so many people, you know, cruising along 70 miles an hour without a helmet, but I suppose it gets into the same kind of lobbying effort, but you know, our groups, everybody we cycle with, that's why when we were doing the research, like as you said, it was just so surprising to see that many people that don't wear them, because in all the group rides that we do, pretty much 100% of the people have helmets on. So, well, we'll take up more next time. Hey, hey, do you organize a ride or know someone that does? Well, we have the perfect solution for you, and it is called VeloCal. VeloCal.org is a slick, web-based bicycle calendar that is extremely easy to set up and use compared to other web-based group calendar systems. So give it a try, as VeloCal is built for and by cyclists, and best of all, it's completely free. As most of you know, I organize a ride on Saturday mornings called the Quivira Park Bike Ride, which goes from May through October here in the Kansas City area. In fact, our first ride is this coming Saturday, May 1st. What I like most about VeloCal is that when I have to change the ride, such as for rain, the service will send out a new email to all subscribed riders of that change. Ride season is starting up, as I said, so please give VeloCal a try for your ride this year. We know you will be very pleased with the results. It is a great program, so please click on the link on the Kansas Cyclist website and start using this calendar today. VeloCal is actually based in Fort Collins, Colorado, and in accordance with new FTC regulations, the Kansas Cyclist podcast does not receive any remunerations from VeloCal, and instead we promote each other's services through cross-marketing on each of our websites. You'll actually see a link to the Kansas Cyclist podcast on VeloCal. I was just in the site setting up the rides for the Quivira Park Bike Group. Today we will be interviewing Alvin Wolf Jr., who is a trial lawyer from St. Louis who handles bicycle accidents. Alvin has been working as a trial lawyer in St. Louis for the past 30 years. He has handled a multitude of cases involving catastrophic injury, wrongful death, and other serious injuries in medical malpractice, bicycle, motorcycle, and trucking accidents. Mr. Wolf received his Juris Doctorate degree from the St. Louis University School of Law in 1979, where he currently serves as an adjunct professor of trial law. He obtained his undergraduate Bachelor of Arts degree from the Washington University in St. Louis in 1976. Alvin's firm, Alvin Wolf Jr. & Associates, has been built by developing quality relationships with their clients throughout Missouri. All their clients are treated with integrity and respect in regards to their individual needs, goals, and objectives. The firm is available 7 days a week to talk with clients and their families. Mr. Wolf published a book called The Total Guide for Motorcycle and Bicycle Accidents in Missouri and the 7 Mistakes That Can Sink Your Claim in 2009, and information about the publication is available at the firm's website. Besides practicing law, Mr. Wolf has donated substantial amount of time to community activities such as the Boy Scouts of America, the Hope Lodge Cancer Hospice, the Jewish Community Center, and Little League Baseball. Alvin lives with his wife, Dr. June Wolf, in St. Louis. They have 3 grown children. Welcome, Alvin, and thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
That's great having you. You have been involved with personal injury cases now for 30 years. Tell us why you took up this specialty, and specifically with bicycle accidents.
Well, I've been riding for a long time. 3 years ago, I got involved with the Multiple Sclerosis 150 ride. I ride with the team every week, and I do a lot of riding on my own. I've handled in the last several years some very significant bicycle, motorcycle accident cases, and I was looking for a new way to market my practice, and I thought that riding a little book or a pamphlet that has some tips that would be helpful would give people a good introduction to who I am and what I do.
And that's your book, The Total Guide for Motorcycle and Bicycle Accidents in Missouri and the 7 Mistakes That Can Sink Your Claim. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. That is true.
Yeah. And so that is why you wrote the book, is to look at your services and make people aware of what their rights are?
Right. I mean, there's so many lawyers. If you turn on the television at any time during the day, you'll be assaulted with yes. commercials, and they're pretty much all the same. My book is what to do if you're in an accident, what questions to ask if you're looking for a lawyer. Certainly, I'd appreciate it if anybody was looking for a lawyer for them to call me, but it's not necessary. The book is available on my website. If you write and ask for it, I'll give you one. You can buy it on Amazon.com. It's available in a lot of bike shops in St. Louis, and all proceeds go to the Multiple Sclerosis Society.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it's I know you've provided us copies and have read it over, and it is very good, very succinct. Before we get on, so you've been riding pretty seriously for about 3 years. Is that what you said?
Well, I've had bikes now, you know, good road bikes for the last 25 years. I've had a mountain bike or a bike for single track for the last 7 years. But I've been on this bike team now for the last 3 years, and doing some senior Olympic competitions. And
excellent.
It's a little bit different than going out for a pleasure ride or running down and getting a quart of milk at the store.
Yeah.
You know, I'll jump on my bike and go do 50, 60 miles and, you know, be able to function the rest of the day.
How many miles does your group put in a week?
Well, we do 60 miles on Saturday mornings. And that's the only time we get together. I generally will put together probably between 100 and 125 miles a week on my bike.
Yep. Well, wonderful.
Is there anything a cyclist should carry with them just in case they have an accident?
Oh, absolutely. They should have some ID with their information. For personal information, if they have any drug allergies, they should have some first aid equipment. They should have a phone number of somebody to call. They should carry an insurance card. At the very least, they should have a cell phone. Hopefully, it would have a GPS device. Let's say if you were doing some single track and you got lost on your own, those are just some basic safety things you should have for your own self-protection. And if you're riding with someone, even though hopefully nothing will ever happen to you as a rider, we've all seen someone in your group get hurt, and quite possibly you could save someone's life with this. Additionally, I would have some non-inflammatory drugs such as Tylenol that would not thin the blood like aspirin in case you're involved in a situation with bleeding. If you have a roll of adhesive tape, you could use that as a tourniquet. Quite possibly, if you have a joint dislocation, it might be good to have a cut-up tube that you could fashion into a sling.
What type of ID do you recommend? Should someone actually carry a driver's license, or is a copy of a license okay, or something like road ID?
Oh, you know, I've got one of these things that just has Velcro and goes around my bike that has all my personal information, and it's got my wife's phone number on there. I think anything would be sufficient. But if you're knocked unconscious, you certainly want someone to be contacted so that some decisions can be made on your behalf.
Yeah, I've been wearing one of those road IDs, I think, for last two seasons now. And I actually further, rather than going through their service, I actually have a lot of websites, and I've set up a personal websites that then there's passwords on the road ID to get to it, but it has all my medical information. So who to call, you know, insurance information, allergies, everything that someone would need. So I know a lot of riders use those because it is on you. That's the good thing. It's not on your bike if you were thrown.
Well, actually, mine is on my bike because if I ever wore it and I took it off, I'd never find it again.
Yeah, my wife complains because I pretty much wear mine all the time. But yeah.
In your book, you list 10 tips that cyclists should follow if they're in an accident. Could you go over those briefly?
Sure. The 10 things that you want to do if you're in an accident are the following. And there's several different ways to go about it. Actually, and it's not even in my book. It's on my blog. I think. You may have taken it from that. But if you've been in an accident, the first thing you want to do is determine if anyone's hurt. So you want to, you know, if someone's down, you want to get them out of the road. You don't want to get in a fight with a person if they either cause an accident, because you never know what that person's going to do. So the first thing you want to do is make sure that everyone is safe, or at least in a position where they're not going to get hurt any worse than they already are. The second thing you want to do is, you know, if you've hit your head, get out of the road, sit down on the curb, take your bike out of the road, or have someone else move your bike, and let the police and other emergency personnel investigate the scene, and let them take care of the housekeeping that needs to be done at the scene. The third thing you want to do after you're out of harm's way is to call the police, because the accident reports are extremely helpful if the police make the report. If you're hurt, let the police know you're hurt. Answer the police questions honestly. If you're dazed or confused, let them know that you need medical treatment, and answer only those questions that you feel sure about, because you don't want to be guessing or speculating. Remember that any statements you can and will be used against you if you admit fault, and it will be too late, and it will look really, really fishy to later say you didn't know what you were saying at the scene. Police, insurance companies, and juries know that your best recollection is immediately after the accident, rather than after you've hired a lawyer and fashioned your statement. Then the other thing that you want to do is be consistent. If you say somebody hit you while going 20 miles an hour at the scene, don't say it was 50 at the hospital, because all these things can be put together to make you look like an exaggerator. The next thing you want to do is to get the other driver's information. You want to get their name, their address, their driver's license number, the make and model of their vehicle, license plate numbers, and their insurance company name and their policy number. If there's any witnesses, you want to get their names, you want to get their addresses, and you want to get their telephone numbers, because your representative may want to talk to them later. If the other driver makes any admissions of fault, you want to get those written down as well. Next, if you have a camera on your cell phone and you're not too badly hurt, take some photos of the scene. If the bike and the car are still on the road, take pictures just so you can see point of impact, what other road conditions were going on, whether it was wet, whether or not there's a traffic signal, a stop sign, just to get an idea of the lay of the land. The next thing is, if you're hurt, go get medical treatment. It's not the time to be a hero. If an ambulance is offered and you're really hurt bad enough, take the ambulance. Don't worry about paying for it until later. The next thing I would recommend is call a good bicycle accident lawyer after you've had your initial treatment and after you know what's going on, because you don't want to start giving statements or doing anything that would not be recommended. If you want to handle it yourself, go ahead. But my dad practiced law for 58 years, and he said that any person that represents himself has a fool for a client. The next thing you want to do is report the accident to your insurance company. Next thing you want to do is do not agree to settle your claim privately with the person at fault in the accident. There's nothing to your advantage to do that. You can deny things later on. Make sure that the police are know about it. Make sure it's reported to the insurance company. Finally, if you get a traffic ticket, don't just roll over because you don't want to hassle with it. Because if you weren't at fault, or you agree to pay the thing just because you're lazy, that may be used against you to say that the accident was your fault. Those are the 10 things.
Hmm. And you said report it to your insurance company. Do you mean your vehicle insurance company, your homeowner's insurance company?
Well, you may want to report it to your homeowner's, because let's say the other guy says you caused damage to his car. That would be a claim that would be made on your homeowner's policy. your vehicle policy is not going to cover you.
So then what can, you mentioned, you know, get an attorney. What can an experienced personal injury attorney then do for a bicyclist, given all that?
Well, here's what we do, and I've got a list of about 29 things, and I'm going to go through them with you. We conduct an initial interview. We will give you education about your case and let you know what to expect. We conduct an investigation. We order request photos, reports, medical records, medical bills. We confer with your doctors. We review insurance policy information. And just for a little sidebar, I just resolved a motorcycle claim for someone where a truck was pulling a trailer that pulled out into the road. And this could happen to a bicyclist too. The truck owner had a $50,000 policy. He was pulling his parents' trailer. The parents told me they had no insurance on the trailer. I filed suit. I got the policy. There's a $500,000 coverage on the case, in addition to the $50,000 that I already got my client. So that's something, you know, you just can't believe anything anybody's going to tell you. We get statements from witnesses. We look at the legal issues. We may have to look at the comparative fault or the contributory negligence, depending on your state. If you have insurance, a lot of these plans have subrogation or reimbursement issues. If you're on Medicare or Medicaid, or there's an ERISA plan, you're going to have to pay them back. We can negotiate those bills. We can get them to pay, in most instances, a percentage of the recovery fees. We negotiate the hospital, the medical bills when we have to. We can see if the case can be settled or if the case has to go straight to court. We look for aggravating circumstances to the case that increase its value. For example, drunk driving, cell phone use, texting, speeding. We give you peace of mind and get the insurance company off your back. We'll prepare you and your client or your witnesses for deposition and trial. We confer with your employer and your accountant for wage loss information and getting tax returns. We get you a trial date. We create exhibits and PowerPoint presentations for trial. We can get the case ready for mediation. We prepare jury instructions. We do opening statements. We prepare pretrial motions. We prepare for witness examinations and cross-examinations. We try the case. We go through post-trial motions. We prepare post-trial appeals. We counsel you, our client. We know what the law is. And finally, we know when to hold them and we know when to fold them. Mm-hmm. So really, it's a lot more than say, hire us, sign your name here, and we'll call you up in a month with some money. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Right. You go into in your book, you talk about some dirty tricks that insurance companies play on claimants. What are those?
Well, you know, one of the tricks is if they'll make you think that if you're nice to them, they'll be nice to you. Nothing is further from the truth. I had an adjuster say to me today, I'm not here to make you look good. And if they're saying that to me as a lawyer, think what they're going to do to you. I mean, some companies, I will admit, are fair in many situations. Other companies are horrendous, and they will do things to delay and denigrate your claim. They'll say your bills are too high. They'll say your bills are too low. They'll tell you you're required to give a recorded statement before they'll pay you any money. And a lot of these things just aren't true.
So you've been in an accident, say, and the insurance company contacts you and wants you to make a statement or sign a form or something. How do you handle it as a cyclist?
I would like to talk to a lawyer before I do anything. And if you have a lawyer, say, this is my lawyer's number, and call him and please don't contact me anymore. See, if you don't have everything lined up when you give a statement to the insurance company, like what you told the police in the police report, what you told the ambulance driver, what you told the triage nurse at the hospital, what you told the emergency room doctor. If you're not consistent, you're going to kill yourself. And I've seen it time and again where the case comes into me and the client has fooled around with it for, say, 3 months, and they've done everything they can to ruin their case. Now, I'm not advocating that I'm going to tell somebody what to say, but I can certainly prepare the person and help them figure out better ways to say the same thing than other ways, which can have negative connotations.
Does it make any difference at all, Alvin, if it's your insurance company versus the other party's insurance?
Oh, absolutely. If, let's say, you get hit by someone who doesn't have insurance, you have an uninsured motorist claim, and you will have a duty to cooperate with your insurance company, but that does not prohibit you from having a lawyer.
Okay.
When you have a claim against your own carrier, they're still not in the business to make you happy. If you look at all these buildings that have names of insurance companies on them, that's from being careful with their money. Let me ask you this. How many buildings do you have named after you? I don't have any named after me.
Right.
What are some of the arguments that insurance companies make to justify lower payments?
Well, let me see. Well, I've already said that the bills are too high. The bills are too low. You delayed the time to go get treatment. You weren't wearing your helmet. Your bike was defective. You were drunk or stoned. You didn't stop in time, even though you saw the guy make the illegal left turn. You exaggerated the other guy's speed so you won't be believed. You exaggerated your complaints. You failed to tell the doctor about your previous back or neck injuries. Your medical treatment went on too long. You stopped your medical treatment too early. Those are just a few of the things I'll tell you to justify a low payment. I hear arguments like this every day. For example, let's say you're drunk or you're stoned and you're on your bicycle. If you're sitting in traffic and somebody hits you, what's the difference?
You also go into the seven mistakes that are guaranteed to sink a claim. I think you might have mentioned some of those. What are those?
If you go to the lawyer and the lawyer then sends you to a doctor or a chiropractor, if you don't go to the doctor before seeing a lawyer, you must not have been very hurt. The second thing is lying to your lawyer. If you don't tell us about previous claims or criminal convictions, you will have absolutely no credibility. The next thing is hiding pre-existing injuries. If, let's say, you've hurt your back and now you hurt your back again, it is what it is. If you don't disclose it, you'll be branded a liar and nothing you say will be believed.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing, making a wage loss claim. Let's say someone's a waitress or a bartender and they don't report their tips. It's very hard to make a claim for lost wages if you don't file your taxes or being honest about it. And you certainly don't want to get up in front of a jury and admit to tax fraud. Misrepresenting your level of activity is another one. Let's say you say, you know, as a result of the injury, you can't ride your bike anymore. Let's say the insurance company then sends out a videographer and gets a movie of you riding, saying that I used to ride, but I can't do that anymore is fine if it's true. But if really what you mean to say is I can't ride like I used to be able to, that's probably more truthful than being prohibited from doing what you used to be able to do. Because a lot of times you know, what we're dealing with in these claims with permanent injuries is a person's permanent lack of mobility. Not that they just can't do things anymore. Certainly if you're paralyzed, you can't do anything. But let's say you have a bad break in an ankle joint and you're a runner. Well, you're probably not going to stop running, at least until you get bad arthritis in that joint. But, you know, it's going to slow you down quite a bit. The next thing that's going to hurt you is if you don't cooperate with your doctor. Worst thing is if you have a doctor's appointment and you don't show up because they just put on DKNA, did not call and cancel. If you don't care about your case, why should the insurance company? And finally, not cooperating with your lawyer, because my feeling is if my client thinks so little of their claim that they're not going to cooperate with me, why should I be wasting my time on that case?
I see. So mainly be honest about things.
Well, that goes through just about everything you do in life.
Right, exactly. Yeah. What does a cyclist have to prove to win a personal injury case? You've gone through, you know, the things that are needed, being honest, etc., but what does it take to win?
Well, I'm just going to take a look in the Missouri jury instruction book, and that's very similar to what other states have. Mm-hmm. And it says your verdict must be for plaintiff, and that would be the rider, if you believe, first, defendant, that would be the other driver, violated the traffic signal or whatever they did, and that then the jury believes that the defendant was negligent. And third, as a direct result of the negligence, the plaintiff sustained damage. And all that means is that the defendant failed. If it's a motor vehicle operator, they have a duty to operate their vehicle with the highest degree of care. That's how negligence is defined in Missouri. A bicyclist, on the other hand, only has to use ordinary care, but that doesn't mean that you can go out there and ride like a jackass. I mean, you have to follow the laws. You have to stop at stop signs. You have to stop at stop lights. You know, you have to let your conscience be your guide. If nobody's looking and there's no cars, what are you going to do? But then what's the likelihood of getting hit either?
And then the state, too, because there's, you know, we've been following, you know, the 3-foot rule, and some states are even trying to make that wider. And then, you know, there's a controversy. Should you ride closer to the curb? Should you ride in the tire lane? And, you know, a car hits you. Does that get into a nuance in the case that the cyclist was
not
too
really
too far over, or do you actually own that lane as a vehicle in the lane?
It's my belief you own the lane.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is no obligation to ride in the curb, you know, in the gutter, because, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that's in there. There's potholes, there's nails, there's glass.
Grates.
There's stuff that's grates that are put in backwards.
Right.
That'll eat your tire. I had one of those once, too. I couldn't believe it when I saw it, but it was true. It was against the Missouri State Highway Commission. They had these bridges, and they put all the grates in with very wide things that would just swallow a tire, and it was perfect. It would take the whole tire and just throw the guy off the bike. But we did get them all put in the right way.
Yeah.
I advocate, you know, you don't want to be a hog, and if the lane's wide enough for a car to pass you, that's fine. But I'm certainly not going to ride in a way that's going to benefit the driver if it's going to put me at risk.
All right. Okay. Why does it seem, however, and this question, I hope I can get it out right, but it just seems, in looking at the cases, that if someone's, you know, found at fault or found guilty, they always seem to get off with a light sentence. You know, we've had a number of cases, or they're even thrown out. And it seems like in a similar case, I'd almost term it like an assault on somebody, there would be much more serious consequences. But just because someone's on a bike, it's different. Do you know why that is?
Well, You know, in a lot of criminal cases, you have to prove intent. If you want to get a very heavy charge that the motorist intended to hurt the person, a lot of the times these are simple negligence cases. For example, if I'm, let's say I rear-end someone in my car. You know, maybe I acted with criminal negligence in rear-ending someone. I don't think the prosecutors really want to work that hard to get a conviction. However, if you've got something involving the use of alcohol or drugs, it's more likely than not that you're going to have a prosecutor that is going to work and get a criminal conviction. At least that's been my experience. Anytime alcohol has been involved, there, you know, depending on the number of previous convictions that person's had and where they are in that particular period of their life, is going to determine what's going to happen, with the caveat that a lot of this justice is so arbitrary and just depends on what the judge wants to do, you know, unfortunately.
And I think the big difference too, you know, a fender bender, as we call it, you know, quote, fender bender, there's not much, you know, there may be a little property damage, people aren't hurt, you know, not a big case. Yeah, I was behind, so, you know, I'm at fault, I'm going to pay. But when you're dealing with a vehicle and a cyclist, that little fender bender turns into possible death of the cyclist or a very serious injury.
Well, I understand that. Yeah. But if it's something, if it's got to be something more than simple negligence.
Yeah. So For example,
the one that I told you about with the finding the $500,000 policy, the guy actually left the scene of the accident, and he, you know, it took the neighbors to turn him in, and it took a couple of weeks for the police to find him. He's got prior convictions, and I do think he's going to go to jail. Now, compare that with a case where I had a girl sitting on her boyfriend's motorcycle in St. Louis last year, got hit by a 17-year-old college freshman who was drunk for the first time, hit her, threw her up on the windshield, left her on the ground like a crumpled rag doll, and left the scene. He got 5 years probation. And, you know, I was strenuously arguing that that kid should at least spend some weekends in jail to set an example for the community. Mm-hmm. That this kind of behavior will not be tolerated, because it just as easily could have been a bicyclist.
Right.
That happened to.
Does criminal charges versus no charges, or acquittal versus guilty, does that make a big difference on civil lawsuits?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, there are certain types of pleas that aren't admissible. You know, if the person does something called an Alford plea, where they admit that there is evidence to support a conviction, that generally, and then if he gets a suspended sentence, that generally is not going to be admissible. But if the guy stands up and says, yeah, I did it, that will be admissible. I mean, the operative question and evidence is, have you been convicted of a felony, or have you ever pled guilty to or been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor? And if something's been pled down and it's a suspended sentence without an oral plea on the record in court, you're not going to be able to use it. I've never had that stop me, though, in being successful on a case where there was some criminal conduct, even though it may not have resulted in jail time or a criminal conviction.
Well, tell us a little bit about some of the interesting cases you've covered involving cyclists.
Well, I had some people down in Oklahoma a couple years ago. They were on a ride, actually. When you say cyclists, you mean bicyclists?
Bicyclists, primarily, yeah.
Okay, well, this one motorcycle claim, these people switched motorcycles, and the guy went from disc brakes to ABS brakes, and he misjudged what had happened, and he ran into this lady, and she ended up with a new shoulder and a new ankle and some knuckles in her hand, and that was a major case. Bicycle case. I had a good friend of mine who was on a bicycle where he went off a curb at a very slow speed. The bicycle had been recalled. The shocks fractured. He got thrown off the bike when the shocks broke and it stopped the wheel from moving. He ended up having neck and back surgeries, went on to have 5 or 6 surgeries, and they both failed. And he's got some permanent issues with his hand, and he lost a very, very large company and basically went broke. That was a significant case. Had another case involving this young man who was a dishwasher, and he used a bicycle to get to work. And there was a local radio personality who yucked it up and got really drunk and ran him over, nearly tore off his foot. That was a very significant result for him. Had a case against the city where there was a hole in the city sidewalk that had been reported. It actually wasn't a sidewalk. It was a bike running trail in a park. And, you know, that caused him to fall. Then we had this case where the guy drove his bike into a grate that was placed the wrong way on a city road, and the bike tire became stuck in the grate. That's, you know, some of my more interesting two-wheel cases. I do lots of other type of law, too.
So you can win against a city or a jurisdiction if they have unsafe crates on the road.
Well, it's foreseeable that people are going to be bicyclists and they're going to ride it on the road. And, you know, my case was against the Missouri Highway Department because it was on a bridge. But I always make it my point when I see grates the wrong way, I report it. Mm-hmm. Because the one thing that we can all do is, you know, these cities defend their cases on the fact that they keep these bureaus for people to report defects. And they say, well, you know, in the city of St. Louis, our sidewalks and our streets will stretch to San Francisco. We don't have time or the manpower to monitor them, and we depend on our citizens to let us know. Well, there's a bureau that if you report it to them and you show that claims have been made and nothing was done, that's a much better way to show notice to the city.
And then if those are public records too, if something was reported, correct?
Right, and yeah. You just have to know the right questions to ask and the right place to go to access that.
Right. Do you think the tide is turning on dealing with road rage by motorists against bicyclists and even motorcyclists?
I see it very, very occasionally. I ride to a gym 3 days a week to lift weights, and you know I'm riding on some very crowded streets, and actually people are pretty darn nice. I mean, they'll wave me through, and you know, maybe they're hoping I'll get hit by the car that's to their right. But you know, they've been actually pretty nice. You do have people who come up on you, and they're talking on their cell phones, and they just start honking like that's going to make a big difference.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I had a situation in Colorado last summer where a guy rode me for 5 miles, and he was screaming at me, and he'd pass me, and then he'd let me pass him, and then he'd get back on my tail again. That was very scary. So, you know, I think with all these share the road signs, I think there's going to be a lot more tolerance. You got, you know, people making a pretty good argument that at least we're not polluting the air and we're trying to do something good for the environment by riding our bikes.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think about 90, probably 95% of the motorists are pretty polite. They, you know, even when you're on a 2-lane road or even a 4-lane and you're in that lane, they, you know, pull way over to get around you. But, you know, we all have had these occasions with this road rage or people, you know, yelling at you or throwing things at you. And some big cases too recently about mm-hmm. that. And then on the lanes, I still, it seems like some people just feel that they have to just stay in that lane. It doesn't matter if you're there and, you know, are going by you at, you know, inches rather than feet. You know, you talked a little bit about texting. What are your thoughts on these laws now to prevent distracted drivers by having no texting laws or even no cell phone use laws?
Well, I think people will continue to text and break the law, but it's sort of like, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't have to wear seat belts, but my kids grew up with seat belts, and even though I didn't, I'm now probably going to put a seat belt on 95% of the time, even though that was a learned behavior for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't grow up with it. There's currently a bill in Missouri that's hopefully going to stop all texting, and, you know, I don't know how you're going to enforce it, but certainly it would be a decent deterrent because most people are law-abiding citizens. And even though it's not anything that would be easily enforceable, or I doubt if a cop would even write a ticket for it, people would stop doing it with the frequency that they are now.
Yeah, I mean, I find, you know, the problem with texting is you're not even looking out. I mean, you have to look down because you have to text. I mean, you know, type something. But yet there's, you know, a lot of research just even on phones. I mean, I've, you know, always have a headset or Bluetooth and keep two hands on the wheel. But even there, they're saying that you're distracted because you're not in the moment. You're listening to that phone call over, you know, something else. But
I hired the guy that Dr. Strahan out at University of Utah that did a lot of the primary research in that area. And the reason for that is that when you're in a conversation and you get into a hairy situation, the person on the other end of the phone doesn't know you're in a hairy situation,
right,
and they will continue to talk, and so will you.
Versus someone sitting next to you, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it just has to be with the other person's awareness. And I don't want to talk about my own personal habits because I never know who's going to end
yeah,
up
right.
with this, because yeah. I have done a lot of lobbying in Missouri about cell phones and the hazards.
Right. Exactly.
You mentioned the road rage incident you experienced in Colorado. I mean, how should cyclists handle that? Is it the basic rule to, you know, kind of not engage?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, everyone carries guns now, it seems like. So, you know, what would prevent an easy rider situation from that? Let's say, what am I going to be able to do with that guy? Am I going to give him the finger because I'm mad? Am I going to further piss him off by engaging him? Is he going to just take his truck and run me down? Is he going to pull out a gun and shoot me? I want the guy to just go away and leave me alone, you know, in a situation like that. I was 20 miles from anywhere when that happened. And, you know, that's pretty scary.
Is it a good idea to get a license number and report it?
It's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, but, you know, you have, how good is your memory? Some guy's chasing you and you get his license, you don't have a pen on you, you're going to get off your bike and write it down, call the cops, you know, just depends on how you want to handle it.
And you don't want to text it, right?
Well, not while you're riding by.
Yeah, right.
Well, that would be tough.
Yeah.
How much does bicycling law differ from state to state? And how does that affect what you do?
Boy, I really don't know. I'm familiar with the laws in Colorado and Missouri, but when you go state to state.
Yeah. So pretty much you have to find a specialist that.
Oh, you
from
don't
that
have
state.
To find a specialist. I mean, I've handled cases in 15 states. I just have to, I learn the law for the particular case I'm involved in. For example, in my Oklahoma motorcycle case, we were able to file it in Missouri because all the residents were Missouri residents, but we did have to use Oklahoma law. So, you know, a lot of this stuff's accessible, and I'm sure there's some tables out there on the internet where you have comparative bike statutes.
Yeah. If someone, say, in Kansas is involved in an accident and they need a lawyer, Can they contact you?
No, I don't. I don't do Kansas. I do have a lot of friends in Kansas. There's a lot of good lawyers in Kansas City who I've done a lot of work with that are also licensed in Kansas.
So if someone needs a recommendation, you can provide them, or at least a referral.
I mean, you know, if the case is significant enough and it makes sense for me to travel, I will travel. I mean, like I said, I've handled cases in 15 states. But, you know, for a case that's worth, you know, $25,000, it makes more sense to get a local lawyer.
Sure.
I know Kansas is a very big state because I've driven it a lot of times. It gets really big after Topeka.
So you haven't done the BAK then?
No, what's that?
Bike across Kansas?
No. Yeah. Sounds like a nice, you know, everyone looks at the map and thinks Kansas is flat, but it's not.
Yeah, that's, we've been telling people, especially in the eastern side of Kansas. Well, Alvin, I know we could talk on and on because very interesting cases and great information. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners?
Wear a helmet. Be careful.
Yep.
If you're wearing iTunes, I recommend getting some headphones that don't go into your ear canal and keep the music low so that you can hear what's going on around you.
Yeah, that's good advice. I actually advise people not to even have those on. To me, that's just another distraction. I enjoy just being out and enjoying the fresh air. So,
you know, I was riding with earbuds, and my teammates really gave me a lot of trouble about it. And I got some headphones that I just wear around my neck, so my ears are completely open. And I don't play it real loud, but it does help sometimes break up the monotony, particularly when I'm out on these lonely, dusty country roads where there's no cars, no nothing. And, you know, I used to be a long-distance runner, so I like having some tunes along with me.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the podcast. I know you have a very busy schedule, and we appreciate the work that you're doing in protecting bicyclists, and best of luck with your MS bike team too.
Hey, thanks a lot. Hope to see you again soon.
We appreciate you downloading episode 19 of the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, and we do hope that you will subscribe so that you will not miss out on future episodes. We have a lot of interesting news, information, bicycle safety tips, and interviews that we have planned for future episodes, so please come back. Also, take the time and leave your feedback, and or if you would like to become a sponsor, please write or send your audio file to podcast@kansascyclist.com or call us at 913-938-6855. Remember, there are show notes on the website which include links to all the information that has been discussed on each podcast. We would also like to thank Mark Fransky for allowing us to use his song called Brush Creek Crossing as our theme music. Take care and cycle safe.